Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, June 4th, and there are a lot of questions that conservatives, I think, should have about the rise of the tech oligarchy or the technocracy, however you want to frame that, with not only the rise of artificial intelligence and some of the regulations or perhaps usage around that. And we've talked a lot on this program about it, but also, you know, where we've come from giving our constitutionally protected rights away as Americans, with things even going all the way back to the Patriot Act, for example, and exchanging perceived safety with big brother government oversight. And so a lot of the right now is concerned about the reported Palantir plan. And so this is coming from MSNBC, even far right influencers, which I guess that would include me, right? Because everybody who's not a crazy liberal is far right to MSNBC. But even far right influencers are creeped out by President Donald Trump's reported plan to work with MAGA-friendly tech company Palantir on merging data on Americans from different agencies into a single location, a development that could lead to the federal government having unprecedented power to spy on and potentially harass Americans. So Newsweek highlighted worried responses from a number of social media and other influencers who are sounding the alarm. So one of those influencers includes my good friend, who's a GOP strategist, and I guess, you know, a media influencer, we'll go with that, John Cardillo, who joins me now. So, John, you know, I think that MSNBC is actually right, that in this sense, that even those of us on the right who generally overall support, you know, the Trump agenda and all of that, are still raising the alarm about this particular plan. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, look, I've been pretty vocal about it. This, to me, is the next generation of horrible, I'll use Elon's word, an abomination of what Jim Clapper did when he was a director of national intelligence, and we found out that the NSA was conducting warrantless spying on Americans. So, you know, a little history, right, Jenna? Big data is nothing new. We used it back when I was in law enforcement and some of the work I did for other agencies after that. And there were data products like ChoicePoint and Accurint, which was later bought by LexisNexis, Thomson Reuters Clear. And they were, at the time, sophisticated. But what they really were one- and two-dimensional products, right? They could, if we were to pull Jenna Ellis or John Cardillo, it would generate about 20 pages on things we own, where we live, if needed credit scores, people we might know, people who lived around us. But this is different. This, when you combine it with AI, and we'll get into it in a second, how in the big, beautiful bill, which to me is the most oxymoronic of oxymorons, big bills should never be considered beautiful. In that bill, there's a provision that strips the states from regulating AI and leaves it up to the federal government. When this is married with next-generation AI, it's going to give three-dimensional pictures of our lives. In other words, without a warrant, government is going to be able to predictively analyze what car we might drive. If people are going to buy too many diesels that year and a Democrat administration wants to step in and limit the flow of diesel for some wacko environmental reason, it's going to be able to track your spending. Look, there's software right now that the restaurant industry uses that can track with your credit card number, because of the POS system, the point of sale system, every restaurant you've ever been to anywhere in the world. that's contributing to that software, and that software is in use with most restaurants around the world. And so they've already have this. Well, it's going to combine all that data. Palantir buys data from the most atypical sources, restaurant software, auto software. They're going to be able to track our every move, and we will never know it. It is beyond bad. And all the MAGA people, I trust Trump. Well, number one, he shouldn't be doing this. So it's not about trusting Trump. When the Democrats take power, they will weaponize this against us. That's why Trump should kill it. And last point, Deborah Birx, scarf lady, lockdown queen, is a senior advisor for the government sector to Palantir. So one of the worst COVID culprits, one of the people who locked down this nation and destroyed lives, is a decision maker in this process. The entire thing should be scrapped last night. I mean, it's terrible.
Yeah, and that's a really great overview, and I'm glad, John Cardillo, that you brought up the One Big Beautiful Bill, or OBBB, as social media is now calling it. And so if you're seeing that acronym, by the way, for listeners, that's what that means. But Marjorie Taylor Greene posted on social media last night, for full transparency, I didn't know about this section of the One Big Beautiful Bill that strips states of the rights to make laws or regulate AI for 10 years. I'm adamantly opposed to this. It's a violation of states' rights. I would have voted no if I'd known this was in there. I posted back and said, you know, respectfully, it's literally your job to know. And that's true for all legislators. But I think that this type of creeping in to not only legislation, and obviously this wasn't a focal point for House members, certainly on the Republican side, but then all of this now with Palantir, all of this coming from a Republican-led majority is very concerning, not just because Democrats will, as you rightly said, weaponize this later, but because we've seen so many different encroachments upon American liberty and freedom coming from Republicans. I mean, even, you know, George W. Bush with the Patriot Act. I mean, we've seen that government on any level shouldn't have this type of opportunity to access privacy and private data of Americans. And so why isn't the Trump administration more concerned about this?
That is, Jenna, that's the multi-billion dollar question. I mean, why aren't they? You know, at the end of the day, I want Trump to succeed. If he succeeds, we all succeed. But I think we also have to come to terms with the fact that Trump, because of his age, he comes a baby boomer. He comes from a generation where institutions were trusted. And I think at his core, he still trusts institutions, right? He says fake news, fake news, fake news. But then he would sit with Maggie Haberman from the New York Times for 4 hours and tell her everything, to the point where the joke was she was his therapist. He talked about, you know, bucking the system, but then he put the worst institutionalists, Fauci and Birx, out front, and our country was nearly destroyed. And now we're seeing these massive spending initiatives with the OBBB, the One Big Beautiful Bill. But this Palantir thing is something else. And I, for the life of me, I think what happened was he's looking at this one-dimensionally as it'll safeguard the nation against a terror attack, against violent crime. It'll be able to profile individuals and figure out where legal aliens are in hiding. But that's going to be a very, very small, a single-digit percentage component of what it's really doing. 99%, 95%, if I'm being generous, of what it'll do is track the predictive and predict the habits and movements of you, me, and your listeners, and every other American. And that is a trade-off we're not willing to take. In fact, I tweeted the other day, it's bothering me that Trump is morphing into George W. Bush. Big spending packages, an expanded surveillance state, cozying up to Qatar and Saudi Arabia. I mean, this is neocon stuff. We have to be intellectually honest and be willing to call it out and be a little vocal about it and hope he course corrects, because this direction is not good for the country.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely spot on, John Cardillo, about Trump's view and assessment of this. And the next logical question, of course, is where is Vice President J.D. Vance in all of this? And that was, if listeners recall, John and I and others on this program had a lot of conversation concerned about Vance's relationship with Peter Thiel and the tech bros and pushing, you know, a lot of this stuff. So I don't see him being some kind of, you know, gatekeeper in this lane at all. For everything else that I, you know, appreciate about him, I think he's doing, you know, a good job pushing back on some of the other type of rhetoric. I mean, you know, this isn't a full-on slam or anything of J.D. Vance, but this is a valid concern and criticism, frankly, that a lot of us on the right who are conservatives called out when he was in the running for the VP slot to begin with, and said if he's the one that's picked to be the running mate, this is a serious concern.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and I think people need to understand how much access the tech oligarchs in the U.S. have. I mean, it's not Peter Thiel has tremendous access to the president and J.D. in particular. Larry Ellison, the founder of Oracle, has tremendous access. Elon is fed up. I mean, only this GOP could get the richest man in the world to donate nine figures so we take back Congress and the White House and screw it up in under 5 months because they aligned with and look like Democrats again. But, you know, this was definitely the tech oligarch presidency and vice presidency. But I did not think they would go this route with a company like Palantir. After Republicans, conservatives, libertarians, and populists screamed and yelled for the last 15 years about warrantless NSA spying, right? I mean, that happened under Obama. Clapper should have been prosecuted for lying to Congress. By the time we found out he did, the statute of limitations had run. We screamed and yelled about this. Trump promised in his first term we'd never see that again. And we're not only back to it, but the tool is far more powerful and far more intrusive.
So what should be the solution, John Cardillo, overall, that, you know, if you're sitting here as an American and saying, you know, we're very concerned that this is the next iteration of what we've seen of the Patriot Act and the lack of privacy within our data, and, you know, then Big Brother and the tech oligarchs and what all of these concerns that we're saying, what's the rational response? Because I don't think that Congress, I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene is proving that Congress clearly isn't paying attention to this.
No, they didn't read the bill. I mean, Marjorie came out and said it. And, you know, disclosure, I know Marjorie a long time. She's a friend. And I think a very smart person, despite the media hell she gets. But Marjorie was 100% right in that she when she read the bill and she realized those AI restrictions, that the states couldn't restrict AI and therefore couldn't restrict the embedding of AI into these surveillance tools. She said, well, you know, the Senate's going to make some changes to the bill, and I'm not going to vote for the new version of the bill if the bill contains this unrestricted AI provision. Now, okay, I've given all the doom and gloom. You do need these tools to keep the nation safe. But if you're not going to codify with legislation rigid restrictions on their use, and you're an attorney, Jenna, with real teeth. I mean, if somebody at the NSA abuses this, it's a 10-year prison sentence. Don't pass go. Don't collect $200. If you're not going to do that, we're going to see worse abuse than we saw under the Obama Clapper regime.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and this also goes into what we've seen, John, with the FISA court and the utter abuse of some of these tools that were sold to the American people to provide the government ostensibly, you know, oversight to say, well, we need to make sure that, you know, there's nobody who's a terrorist organization or an individual or, you know, whatever that we can have, you know, spying on and some of these things that are a necessary government tool. I mean, that was the line that was sold to the American people. And then obviously the FISA court has been utterly abused to trample Americans' rights and citizens, and having our own government spy on us, even a former candidate to the American presidency. I mean, this is just, you know, beyond, so far beyond what the founders ever intended when they drafted the Fourth Amendment to say, you know, against unreasonable search and seizure, and to say that we should all be protected in our person and our privacy. I mean, this is something that even the founders, who probably couldn't have even contemplated all of the tools that we're using now, recognize the potential for government to abuse their power and their oversight and their investigation into the privacy of Americans. And so this seems to be yet another tool that could be just as abused as FISA and everything else. And so we have to have, and I think that's the solution we're talking about, right, is that we have to have known very solid restrictions and accountability and enforcement for those restrictions, not just, well, you know, but then there's 17,000 exceptions to those restrictions. So in theory, that's exactly a nice practice, but we're going to go ahead and just do whatever we want anyway.
Yeah, no, exactly right. It's got to be, these have to be single line bills, right? Now, I will say this about FISA. I had a conversation with an old friend of mine, yours, and many people, Dan Bongino, on Saturday morning. And I can't discuss a lot of what we discussed, but I'm very comfortable. I know there's a lot of criticism of he and Kash Patel not being as proactive as people want. We had a very long chat. Dan's an old friend. They really are. They're just, in law enforcement, certain things you can't discuss. But one of the things that I will share is we spoke about FISA, and Dan was adamant that he and Kash are being microscopic with FISA warrants, and they are personally responsible for signing each one. Now, we'll have them, right? The director has a 10-year term, so we'll have Patel into the next administration. Presumably, Dan will stay on board or someone of his caliber. But again, we're lucky right now that we have two guys at the helm of the FBI that are scrutinizing FISA warrants and not letting any of the nonsense that happened in the past happen again. We're not going to have that in a Democrat administration, right? Democrats will just fire Patel and replace him with another Comey or Ray, who will, again, abuse the process, which is why we need these single-line bills that are very specific with no exceptions.
Well, we got to take a break here, but John Cardillo, really appreciate your comments and, you know, raising this to our attention. And like you, I have a lot of confidence in Kash Patel and Dan Bongino, just knowing them personally and knowing especially Dan's fidelity to the Constitution, to law enforcement, for the purpose in which it was originally designed, not the abuse of power that obviously has happened in American history and even recently. So we need to, as conservatives, recognize that sometimes even Republicans can push things that we should not support. It should not just be, oh, everything's green lighted just because the GOP voted yes on this. We need to scrutinize this. We need to understand what exactly is going on. Is this a trampling of our rights? What can we do about it? So we'll continue to follow this story. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
The month of June has been hijacked by the anti-Christian culture to show their pride in something God calls an abomination. When you support AFR, you help us continue to stand for godly values and provide the resources for you to stay in the know about the enemy's tactics. To say thank you for your gift this month, we'll give you the booklet, Inside the LGBTQ Push of the 1990s, to help strengthen your convictions. Just go to afr.net/offers. afr.net/offers.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, you may have heard that RFK Jr. and the HHS ended the COVID vaccine recommendation for kids and pregnant women. And so this is, of course, causing a little bit of the meltdown on the left. But this is something that we have frankly known all along, is that children especially are not at risk for COVID in the same ways, even initially, that some in other higher risk categories were. So this seems to be a very good call. But let's welcome in our friend who goes by the moniker of Raw Egg Nationalist on social media. He's an author and has, you know, great stories, as well as the author of The Eggs Benedict Option. And Raw Egg, always appreciate you joining. And, you know, this is something that should have happened a long time ago. And I think this is one great practical and concrete step that the HHS is doing to kind of roll back the Biden era travesties.
It's good to be back speaking to you, Jenna. Yeah, I think this is really long overdue, as you say. I mean, you know, these vaccines, experimental treatments, really, I think that's the best way to think of them. Gene therapies, even, you know, they've been recommended now for for 4+ years, and they've been given to children, very young children, and they've been given to pregnant women as well, you know, with potentially unknown effects on their unborn children as well. So, I mean, yeah, it's long overdue. You know, RFK promised that he would do this, and he has done it. And so I think it's a victory. However, there is now another Moderna mRNA COVID vaccine that is now going to go through trials, you know, for regulation. And RFK has said, look, this is going to be subject to a very different set of safety regulations than the previous mRNA vaccines, you know, which were rushed through and given emergency use authorization. But that set off some alarm bells. People are worried that what we're going to see again is we're going to see some kind of fudge where, you know, an mRNA, an experimental treatment gets waved through actually without being fully tested. And, you know, we're only now starting really to reckon with the negative health effects. You know, we're seeing studies come out that are really, really worrying. So one study that I talked about actually on Twitter a couple of weeks ago was a Czech study that showed that actually vaccinated women in the Czech Republic are now having 33% fewer pregnancies than unvaccinated women since the pandemic. So, I mean, it's really bad, really bad stuff happening. And I think that what we need is we need to put a total hold on all mRNA vaccines until we can actually understand how they really work and what their potential health effects are.
Absolutely. And I think that's all that conservatives have been calling for since the very inception of this, because we know that these are experimental. I mean, we've always known that. And I have always been very openly against any sort of mandate or any sort of requirement by the government, even push by individual doctors when they really don't know the long-term effects. And we saw just this week that the U.S. government has canceled that major contract with Moderna for development of a bird flu vaccine. And I think that this is perhaps showing that HHS is going to be at least a little more cognizant of some of these risks and not just presume that these pharmaceutical companies are serving the best interests of health and of Americans, but also even just frankly knowing what they're doing.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm you know, Kennedy hasn't let up in insisting that corporate capture of industry of regulators, you know, like the FDA, is a big problem. It's a huge problem, and you know that needs to be addressed. I mean, it's been mentioned in the new Maha Commission report, which was released a couple of weeks ago, you know, which very stridently denounced the corporate capture of agencies like the FDA. But I do think that actually what we really need is something like a moratorium on these kinds of technologies, these new experimental technologies. What we need to avoid is what happened during the pandemic, which is actually using live humans out there in the world as a test population, as guinea pigs, essentially, for these experimental technologies. You know, I mean, we have vaccines already that work or don't work, depending on your viewpoint. But they've certainly been tested far more than these experimental technologies. And I think now is absolutely the time. Kennedy is the right man. He's, you know, he's got the right track record on this stuff, and I think he needs to be as strident as possible and say, look, actually, we need to stop. We need to stop, and we need to take stock, and we need real science that isn't perverted by corporate interests, that isn't being gerrymandered for the sake of profit, so that we can understand whether actually it's a good thing to be altering people's genetic makeup using these experimental technologies.
Yeah, so well said. I'm speaking with Raw Egg Nationalist, who is also on social media. You can follow him and also read his book, The Eggs Benedict Option, among other great articles that he has in a wide variety of publications. And, you know, we talk a lot about HHS and what RFK Jr. is doing, and this is a great thing, and I'm certainly a champion of that. What about Dr. Jay Bhattacharya, who's now the head of the NIH and replaced Fauci? He was a huge advocate during COVID in 2020 for other solutions, not pushing the vaccines. Unfortunately, Trump and the administration didn't listen to him. Dr. Atlas, I did an entire show with him that was really in-depth and lengthy that you can still find on, you know, YouTube and other places that documented, you know, his whole history there and what happened. But that role, I think, is very important along with HHS to be more cautious and have better protocols. And so what do you see from Dr. Bhattacharya as well?
Well, yes. I mean, I think Bhattacharya, he was a great appointment. He's, you know, like RFK Jr. himself, he's been a strident opponent of these experimental technologies. He's spoken out at cost to himself. He's obviously a courageous man. He obviously believes, I think, fundamentally in the mission of Make America Healthy Again. So I think he's the right person to lead the FDA. But what we need to see now, absolutely, is we need to see all of that rhetoric, that opposition throughout the pandemic, that sort of brave record. We need to see it actualized into some concrete actual steps. You know, I mean, there was a, you know, this Maha Commission report was released a couple of weeks ago that I just mentioned, and it was quite interesting actually to note that it didn't talk about the COVID vaccines. There wasn't any mention of the COVID vaccines as, you know, one of probably the most significant recent health intervention for children and for adults that's had a, you know, like a society-wide negative effect that is potentially, you know, really making people very, very ill. So what I don't want to see is a climb down. And it may be the case that there isn't one happening, that there isn't, you know, that it isn't going to happen. But I do think that there needs to be some reassurance. I think there needs to be some strong messaging on this, some messaging that is consistent with, you know, the previous messaging while these two men weren't in government. And we also actually need to get a sense of what's going to happen next. You know, what is RFK Jr. going to do? What is Jay Bhattacharya going to do to protect the public and to ensure that that the dreadful mistakes of the pandemic never happen again?
Yes. And with that, what is Congress going to do to ensure that a lot of these really good decisions are codified and that there is more regulation or at least protection for citizens against these types of experimental medications, or, you know, whether you want to call it a vaccine shot, whatever, that there are more protections against something like in 2020 and following ever happening again, because we have a good HHS right now under RFK Jr. in this area, but that could change. And we've seen the kind of dramatic swing back and forth between different types of administrations. And this is why, as we've continued to talk about on this show, this is why Congress needs to step in and ensure that the priorities of protecting the American people are actually codified. And the judicial branch also needs to do its job as well. But I'm not seeing a lot of attention to this at all coming from Congress. I mean, they seem just so distracted by everything. But in your view, Raw Egg Nationalist, what would be the best a kind of strategy from the executive and the legislative branch to ensure that some of these guardrails are in place for the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need probably a mixture of executive orders, perhaps, and also new laws. We absolutely do need new laws. I mean, it's not enough just to have RFK Jr. in a position of authority, being given a platform to speak with the backing of the US government, you know, as a member of the US government. I think we need new regulations, certainly. We need new laws. I think we need bans on certain chemicals in particular. And this is actually something that was notable in the Maha Commission report, again, that looks a bit like a climb down. There was a story about this. I think it was in the Washington Post about the fact that certain references to companies like Monsanto were taken out of the report references to lobbying by particular companies, you know, as examples of industry capture, corporate capture were taken out too. There was also, I think, EPA head Lee Zeldin said, look, we're not going to have a European style regulatory system for chemicals, because you know, it's well known that in the EU the regulatory system is much, much tighter, and chemicals like atrazine, for example, the horribly toxic herbicide that's used in, you know, by the millions of gallon across the US each year, that's actually banned in the EU. There are some quite worrying signs that suggest that actually we're going to get these quite strident documents like the Maher Commission report. We're going to have Kennedy, you know, continuing to speak out. But are we going to have support from the are we going to have support from the legislative branch? Are we going to have support from the executive branch? That's what we need. We need to turn these recommendations, this rhetoric into action, into regulation. We can, you know, Kennedy can work with industry, and he has worked with industry to remove some red dyes already. You know, that's a positive step, but really that's a baby step compared to what needs to be done. I mean, we do fundamentally need new laws. We need executive orders. We need to create a whole new system for ensuring that products, whether we're talking about pesticides and herbicides or food additives, are actually safe. To be in the environment and to be in Americans' bodies.
And we've got to take a break here, but Raik Nationalist, all of this is a great perspective on a comprehensive strategy. I mean, we can point out significant singular wins, like, you know, removing this recommendation for the COVID vaccine for kids and pregnant women. That's a great thing, but it just underscores the fact that we have so much more work to do. And I really, really hope that Congress actually gets involved in all of this instead of just basically rolling over and passing a legislation like the One Big Beautiful Bill that now we're learning has so much pork and negative in it that it shouldn't have been passed in the first place. But you know, we'll see how this goes. So we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. This June 24th marks 3 years since Roe v. Wade was overturned. But here's what you may not know. Abortion numbers have surged to a 10-year high. The battleground has shifted from the courtroom to our homes. Today, over 60% of abortions happen through the abortion pill, taken in silence and often alone. Preborn Network clinics are standing in the gap, meeting women in their most desperate hour. And here's what they're seeing. Young mothers, terrified and misled, are delivering their babies, tiny, perfectly formed, onto bathroom floors. These precious babies, once called just tissue, now are lifeless. 11% of these women who take the abortion pill will suffer serious health complications. Countless others carry emotional scars for a lifetime. When you give to Preborn, you're not just saving a baby, you're saving a mother as well. You're giving her hope, financial support, and the truth. Preborn has already rescued over 350,000 babies, but there are so many more who need our help. Your tax-deductible gift makes this mission possible. To donate now, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, we talked previously about how the Democrats have launched this $20 million effort to win back young men and young voters. The program name is Speaking with American Men, or SAM, and their budget is $20 million over 2 years to research, engage with, and win over young male voters. And interestingly, Nate Silver, who, you know, some of you may know as the pollster, pointed out an uncomfortable truth for Democrats in an article that he wrote, that there's an entire demographic who take antidepressants and go to therapy and then think that we should all listen to them on how to run the country and end up voting Democrat. So this is what Nate Silver said in the article. Although I've seen it written about elsewhere, I was honestly surprised by how strong their relationship is. Among voters who report poor mental health, liberals outnumber conservatives 45% to 19%. Among those who report excellent mental health, conservatives outnumber liberals 51 to 20. So the young men that Democrats have trouble with aren't necessarily the ones who have been captured by the conservative quote-unquote manosphere or who are looking for a helping hand. Rather, it's those who report relatively high mental health and see Democrats as being too neurotic or perhaps constraining their opportunity to compete and reap the rewards of their work. So joining me now to discuss is my good friend Ryan Helfenbein, who is the executive director of the Standing for Freedom Center at Liberty University and also the vice president of communications. And Ryan, I think this is a really fascinating correlation because when we talk about the broader worldview and, you know, you and I, as Christians talk about this all the time, especially on this radio network, we talk about how our worldview and who we are as human beings made in the image of God, how we view the truth of the gospel of Christ, and then how that impacts and necessarily directs the rest of our lives and our engagement. I think this is a fascinating correlation between those who report poor mental health or they are hooked on some of these pharmaceuticals that largely, and I'm not categorically saying that they're not helpful in some instances, but I do think that we have an over-medicated society that instead of dealing with, you know, genuine problems of the heart and soul and spiritual problems, we tend to, as secular therapy would do, just mask them through antidepressants. And instead of, for example, dealing with guilt, dealing with shame, dealing with problems, we just mask that and try to numb our problems. And then we wonder why a lot of these same individuals who aren't dealing in truth and in their life in the correct way, then go and vote for a party that is affirming their sinful lifestyles that they feel guilt over. I mean, I think that there is a big worldview correlation here.
100%. And I how fitting it is that you went just from talking about the Maha movement to this, because it all is linked together. We are human beings created in God's image, body and soul. We're not just a body, we're a soul. We're not just a soul, we're also a body. And those things go together. When we present the gospel as Christians, the good news that Jesus Christ saves sinners, we're not just presenting a message, but a way of living, a manner of living. It's not our way of living that saves us, but we're saved then to be free to live in the fullness of life that God has meant for us, that he has designed for us. And part of this age, part of the deception of this age, is suppressing the truth and unrighteousness. And it's not just truth in the abstract, it's truth in the sense of a model for living. And so often the way mental health cases are presented is it's all about the mind. It's about how to deal with stress or anxiety or depression. And these are all just chemical imbalances in the brain. And if you just take this pill or that pill, or, if you get a little bit more sleep, everything is going to be better. And we know that's not the case. It is all about how we live before one another, and we live before God. And it does not surprise me in the correlation that people with a particular worldview that is naturalistic, Darwinian, people who are disconnected from God, from faith, they feel lonely. They feel anxious. They feel, these intrusive thoughts, thoughts of suicide. What are those? Where do they come from? And I think ultimately the Bible has a pretty clear explanation that we are alienated from God because of our sin, and we need to be made right before him and be reconciled to him. And when the Apostle Paul presents the gospel, he goes from church to church, synagogue to synagogue, and he's also saying, hey, don't just hear our message. Consider our way of living, how we are living out our faith before you. Follow this example. Paul says, follow my example, not just in the way of living righteously in the church, but in the community. And so I think that is what's needed now more than ever, is a recognition. You can't buy this next generation, especially not at $20 million. These AstroTurf campaigns to win young men, win young women, who are riddled with guilt and know the disastrous consequences of this kind of life, of liberalism, of leftism, this sort of radical individualism. They recognize that there is no fruit in that. It's a dead-end life. It's a life of suicide. It cuts off the next generation, whether by castration or by abortion, and certainly leaves people depressed and lonely in their aging years. Democrats have a real problem because they cannot message to the youngest generation. And at $20 million or even $20 billion, I don't think this kind of strategy is going to work because it's not realistic.
And it's not giving people ultimately what they want, which is to be fulfilled. And we know that that type of fulfillment that every human being yearns for can only be found in the truth of the gospel of Christ and the person of Christ. And so what they're selling is a completely empty, sinful lifestyle. And this is why the lies that are trapped and embedded in even right now with Pride Month, to say, well, just affirm whoever you want to love, totally fine, whatever gender you want to be, totally fine. People are waking up to the fact that feminism, liberalism, this you know, sex on demand, licentious lifestyle culture, the sexual revolution, all of these things that have been peddled over the last 50 and 60 years, and even more acutely over the last decade or so, are total lies. And so I think there's also an inverse correlation here, Ryan, that when you have young men who are recognizing that traditional marriage is a good thing, being masculine in biblical ways is a good thing, being leaders is a good thing, work and fulfillment and all of these types of character qualities that are godly is a good thing, that necessarily then correlates with how they vote. And so what the Democrats are facing here isn't just a political or messaging problem. It is a fundamental problem with their worldview, that they are not going to capture the Christians that have been liberated from sin. And I think that really is our lesson as Christians, that we need to engage the culture, because if we are winning more and more young men and women for Christ, that will have an effect on politics, even if we don't message a single thing about who to vote for.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that, that we cannot abandon the public square. Christians have a unique responsibility in this age to be obviously a faithful witness, but to promote righteousness. And to promote it not just within the four walls of the church, but to promote it publicly in the civic sphere, to show people an alternative. When Jesus said to his disciples said, "Hey, Lord, teach us how to pray." He gives them the Lord's Prayer: "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." We recognize as Christians that freedom, political freedom, is not just from an Enlightenment philosophy or an ideology that was written 200 years ago. It comes from spiritual freedom, and it's the inbreaking of another kingdom and another world into our own. And as Christians, we recognize that it begins with forgiveness. It begins with receiving the righteousness of Christ. We know we can't do anything to save ourselves, that Jesus Christ saves sinners. We also recognize then that there's a pattern of living that comes as a result of that. And government can't address these issues. Government ultimately can't address the problem that we're seeing with sexual sin that's gone rampant. In the 1960s, it was free love. We know that that was a total lie. There's nothing free about love. Love comes with sacrifice. Love comes with discipline. Love comes in a covenant. The covenant is marriage. And so young people recognize that it's not just about what people say. They know that these are lies that are being foisted upon them. They know that they come with deep baggage. We're in Pride Month. You know, one of the things is the young people that have grown up in the shadow of the LGBT movement, the trans movement, even surrogate children who have been raised by two moms or two dads. You can lie to the public about what that's really like, but you can't lie to a child. A child knows. A child knows that they desperately need a mother and a father. And so I think this
I think the generation that we're in, this is the wake-up moment. And I think people that choose life, choose righteousness, ultimately choose Christ, they're going to find that they will reap the rewards and benefits, not just in their lifetime, but for the generations that come after them, the children that they raise in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. We have to protect that future, and we have a very unique opportunity in this generation to do that.
Yeah, so well said. And I agree with you. Ryan Helfenbein, who is my special guest this morning, executive director of the Standing for Freedom Center and vice president of communications at Liberty University. And so, you know, with this opportunity, I think then we have to look at the state of the church, which we talk about quite frequently as well. And as much as the Democrats are off message, I think the church is off message broadly and overall. I mean, obviously not specific individual churches. My church here in Florida, I love and is great and is teaching the truth of the gospel of Christ. And there are some really great churches around the country. But I'm talking about, like, you know, kind of big Eva overall, where we're still kind of in this, you know, seeker sensitive kind of movement of let's make everybody just feel comfortable, come in, it doesn't matter your lifestyle, all this. I think we're really missing the opportunity that young men and women are hungry for truth, they're hungry for answers, and the biblical worldview has the answers for life's problems and issues and answers to questions like, who are we as human beings made in the image of God? Who is God? How do we deal with how to live our lives in a way that ultimately will be for our good and for the good of society? I mean, it's something where we shouldn't be shying away from these questions, because the Christian worldview has the only internally consistent answers for those questions, and the church by and large is just totally ignoring that opportunity.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head when you mentioned the seeker-sensitive movement, because for the longest time, I think in the evangelical world, we have imbibed on this idea that we got to coddle those outside the church in order to bring them into the church. The idea was, it's the idol. And I don't like this terminology, but I've reluctantly adopted it, the idol of evangelism. And what I mean is, of course, we're called to evangelize. Of course, we're called to the Great Commission to make disciples of all nations. But we've sacrificed discipleship at the altar of evangelism, not the kind that is prescribed in Scripture, but the kind in this sort of new modern era where many pastors have this idea that we're going to seek and save the lost, we're going to reach this next generation, but we're going to do so through a PC means of reaching them. We're going to mask the gospel. It's going to be a bait and switch. We're going to try to find ways to get people into the church and interested in Christianity without telling them the total truth. And that actually is a recipe for disaster. We've seen that it has not produced the kind of disciples, the kinds of converts that stick and stay. But many people have left disillusioned, just like the rich young ruler. It was that moment of honesty when Jesus cut to the core, sell everything you have and come follow me. He didn't want to do it. And I think this generation in particular, the previous generations kind of fallen into that trap. I think this generation is recognizing that there is a real cost to discipleship. And people are willing to pay that cost because they are seeing the disastrous consequences of a life that is seeking your own pleasure, seeking your own gain. So I think there are some folks who right now are saying, hey, I would rather choose Christ than to have this disastrous life that you're seeing on the political left. The disastrous life, as you frame even the beginning, where you this high suicide, mental health, depression, all of it, because at the end of the day, there is no gain, there is no reward. It is not lasting. So the church has got to get the story straight, and that is to understand the gospel, that Jesus does save sinners, and to tell the unvarnished truth. And I think that's why sometimes the young men in particular are flocking to other voices, alternative voices that are not conservative, that are not Christian, but are telling the unvarnished truth And that's where I think the church has to step up. And we've got to shake off the illusion of the seeker-sensitive movement. Mm.
So well said, Ryan Helfenbein. You can follow him on X at @rhelfenbein. And what a great point, the difference between evangelism and discipleship, where the church should be focused Sunday mornings on feeding the flock and discipleship, yes, evangelize, and do that in a way that brings people in because of the truth, because we're telling the truth in love. But the primary purpose of the church is not to just continue to give milk over and over and over, but to give the meat of the word and to help us as Christians grow in the grace and knowledge of the Lord. So as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.